This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Now, this shiur is a little bit different from the regular style because, in fact, it's not a shiur at all. And things must be clearly defined because otherwise one loses standards. A shiur is when you, in an academic way, I mean academically, professionally, explain Chazal. A sermon, a drosha, is when you put forward an idea and you use Chazal to illustrate the idea. In both cases, it's Torah. In both cases, it's emes, it's truth. If a rov, if a person who can learn, expresses an opinion, the chances are he's researched that opinion before he expresses it, particularly if he uses the forum of a drosha or a shiur to express that opinion. So even if he doesn't quote any sources for it, you can be sure that that opinion is based on many years of learning. However, in a shiur, he will show you the development of the idea out of Chazal, and the purpose of the shiur is to explain the Chazal, and emergent from that come the various ideas that are expressed in the shiur. Whereas in a sermon, in a drosha, the rabbi will start with an idea, and he'll present his idea and develop his idea using his own illustrations and using Chazal, using rabbinic literature as one or some or all of his illustrative material. He won't prove anything from the Chazal, he will illustrate from the Chazal. And there's a big difference. When you prove something, it's got to be solid. If you're giving a shiur on a Chazal, then you've got to show how you get from the Chazal to your concept. And it has to be clear, it has to be professional, it has to be well done. Drush, which is a sermon, medrash, has to be equally well done, but from other points of view. There it's not that essential that you must be able to say, that's what that Chazal means. Because you're using the Chazal as an illustration of a point, not as a proof for a point, not as your source for a point. Source of your point is your Torah background, that's your source for the point. And the Chazal is an illustration. Tonight, although it will be taking the form of a shiur in the sense that it's much longer than sermons are today, although in times gone by, and not that long gone by, talking only a generation or two, a drosha could be an hour or two, sometimes three. A good sermon was 2 or 3 hours, and one can still, here and there, in Yerushalayim, there are a couple of good darshonim that one can still hear long sermons from. But today, people just aren't geared to listen to sermons for more than a short period. So the shiur will take a form of a shiur as we know it. However, what I'm going to tell you is not going to be based on particular Chazal. I'm going to show you an illustration of Chazal at the end. But it's going to be based rather on a Torah approach to the contemporary situation in which we find ourselves. And here too, I must remind you, our whole approach which we've been following since the outset, and that is that our learning in this space of Medrash isn't and hopefully never will be an academic exercise. It's meant to be an approach to one's living. And the same as I would expect to have shailas in matters of kashrut, and in matters of taras ha-mishpocha, and in matters of Shabbos, and in matters of Yom Tov, and in matters of business, dinim, so I would expect to have shailas in hashkofa. How does one apply this thought? How does one approach this problem? What is the total view of this situation? So as to make sure that one doesn't live a dual life, that in terms of technical halacha we're frum, and our Shabbos is a Shabbos and our kashrus is our kashrus, but our reading the paper is not frum. Yeah. There's a Torah way to read the paper. There's a Torah way to understand the newspaper, to understand what's going on in the world. And the purpose of these shiurim is to start developing a hashkofa, an attitude, an approach to the day-to-day situations that confront every life in our time. Now we are on the threshold of a new era. Call it a new decade if you want, but even if it wasn't a new decade, I would call it a new era. Because the signs are that there's been a turnaround in world thinking. And besides, the last era couldn't go any further. But it is a new decade as well. And we've seen, right from the beginning of the century, that each decade has had its nature, has had its personality. There was the World War in the second decade of the century. There were the 1920s. There were the 1930s with the Depression. There were the 40s. There were the 50s where science reigned supreme. There were the 60s which were meshuggah. There were the 70s which were awful. And who knows what the 80s will be. Furthermore, if one doesn't like to classify these eras by secular decades, it maybe isn't so coincidental that our Jewish decades coincide and we're going into the 40s. And in terms of Jewish decades too, obviously, right through, certainly this century and probably always, but things haven't changed quite as fast as they've been changing over the past few decades. Each decade has had its own style. Now the very first Rashi on the Sedra, really, Rashi discusses why this Sedra, unlike any other Sedra, doesn't start at the beginning of a line or doesn't even leave a space between the previous Sedra. And Rashi brings a Medrash, Shebikesh Legalus Es Haketz, Yaakov wanted to reveal the end to his children, the Nistan Mimenu, and his mind went blank. The Rebbeinu Shalom stopped him. So one has to be careful altogether with even attempts at predicting the future. What Yaakov wanted to do was to using his Korach HaNevuah, using his prophecy, Legalus Es Haketz, to tell them what will happen right till the end, till the coming of the Mashiach. And that the Rebbeinu Shalom wouldn't have. But even to say what's going to happen tomorrow, you have to be a Novi. You have to be a prophet. And there isn't Nevuah today. We don't have prophecy today. So if anybody tells you what's going to happen tomorrow, or what's going to happen next year, or in the next 10 years, you must know that they're foolish, because they're not Nevi'im, they're not prophets. However, that doesn't mean that you've got to go around with a totally blank mind as to what's going to happen tomorrow. Firstly, you remember the Rashi we learnt on the Shema, on Bahayayim Shamoya Tishma, which literally translated means, and it will be, that if you heard, you will hear. Says Rashi, that means if you heard the old stuff, you will hear the new stuff. And we learned and we understood that an understanding of Chidushim, when you're learning a piece of Gemara, if you want to be Mechadish, if you want to be creative, and you want to discover something new in the Gemara, the method to do it is not to say, right, now I'm going to be Mechadish. What should I be Mechadish today? The method is to go over what you've got and deepen your knowledge of what you've got and what you've had and revise over and over again. And all of a sudden, the Chiddush will start sprouting. You'll see the little buds, you'll see the little leaves coming forth, and you'll get the feeling that something great is going to happen. That's how inspiration happens. For inspiration, one doesn't lock oneself in a room and pray and put on a very holy air and wait for inspiration. That's not how it happens. It's hard work. And it's work in the past that brings inspiration for the future. The great writers, the great secular writers, not to mention certainly Lavdil, the Torah writers, disciplined themselves to write. A fellow like Forster, who was a post office clerk, used to sit down for 3 hours, I think it was, I don't remember the exact time, every morning before he went to the post office, and he used to write. What are you going to write if you don't have inspiration? The hippies wait for inspiration before they write. And I don't think the hippies have left us much literature. Writers write. They force themselves into a discipline. And a small percentage of what they write becomes great. They write, they force themselves, they go over and over again. And sometimes an idea starts emerging. Sometimes there's inspiration. But if you don't start working, the inspiration will never come. To say, I'll learn when I feel like it, I'll be mechadish when I feel like it, I'll go to a shir when I feel like it, you'll never go to a shir and you'll never learn and you'll never be mechadish. One has to set the seder in the past, one has to set the seder as to how things are done, revise the past, and then it's miraculous how all of a sudden things start sprouting and coming forward. So, in approaching this new era on the threshold of which we find ourselves, what we've got to really do is study the past. And in the past, we'll find the seeds for the future, because a tree doesn't grow out of nothing. There's a seed in the ground years before the tree appears. And if you want to know what kind of tree is going to grow, just dig around in the sand and you'll find the seed. When you find the seed, you can study the seed and you'll be able to see the tree. You might ask then, why does the Mishnah tell us, Ezehu Chochom, who is a wise person, Haroye, Hanoyelot, somebody who can see the future? The answer to that is that that's not the correct translation. It doesn't say Ezehu Chochom Haroe Es Asher Yivoleid. It doesn't say a Chochom is a man who can see that which will be born. It says Haroe Es Hanoilo, that which is born. A Chochom is a person who can see that which has been born now. A Chochom is a person who's in touch with the present.
He doesn't wait till the baby grows up before he says, oh, there's a young man before me. I didn't even relate to him before. I didn't even notice him. The moment the baby is born, he's aware that there's a person in potential here. And he starts planning and analyzing this person to understand what kind of a person he is and how he must be related to. To be roya es hanoilad, to see that which is already born, that's chokhmah. To see what's going to be born, that's nevuah, that's prophecy, that we can't do. But to know the present well, that's all you need. Because if you know the present well, and it has to be extremely well, it's roya es hanoilad. You've got to see it. And seeing means that you're prepared to act on it. Right? On what you hear, you don't act. If you hear that the gold price is going up tomorrow, you don't buy gold. But if you could see theoretically a newspaper from tomorrow with a gold price tomorrow, you would buy gold. We trust our vision a lot more than we trust our ears. So when the Gemara talks about, or the Mishnah talks about haroyeh, somebody who sees, it means that they see with sufficient clarity to allow them to act. And that's the brilliance of a chokhmah, that he sees the present so clearly that he acts on it, and he does well.
So what we've got to try and do is study the past and become extremely familiar with the present. By the present we mean right now. And if we have that clear, then we can approach the 80s, whatever they're going to bring us, with confidence. Before we look at the immediate past, let's look at the growing ground of the immediate past. That's the 20th century.
We can't go back much further than the 20th century because we weren't around and we don't quite understand it. And even the early part of the 20th century,
we're not going to analyze this evening because I certainly don't understand it. But what is it that has typified the 20th century? What is it that has typified the last 70 years? Starting off, even before that, I would say, more than anything else, to use one word, hefkerut. Hefker means abandon. Something without an owner is hefker. Hefkerut expresses itself in two areas. I can express hefkerut if I abandon my property. That means I no longer regard myself as the owner of my property. And there can be hefkerut if I regard myself as not having an owner. There are two kinds of hefkerut, to my owner and to my possession. This all started actually before the turn of the century. And it started in two areas, primarily. It started in art and in philosophy, and a little bit in literature. It started in art by the Impressionists. All of a sudden, it was no longer important to know what the world really looked like. That was the business of photography. It's amazing that the camera, maybe if one really analyzes it carefully, it's feasible that the camera brought about the whole atmosphere of hefkerut of the 20th century. Maybe the camera was the most important invention that has affected the style of our life. Because the camera changed art. Now the artist had to say to themselves, well look, just to paint things as they are the way Rembrandt did, we've got cameras for that. So what's the function of art? Ah, said the artist. With art, I'll show the world how I see the world. That's all that's important. All that's important is my vision of the world. What a vase of flowers looks like is not important. What I see in a vase of flowers, that's what is important. And art became totally subjective. And in philosophy, you had existentialism starting at about the same time, a little bit later. When you had the same idea coming across that what is true is not important, what is objective is not important, what's important is how I feel about what's going on. That's all that's important. My experience of life. My existence in this world is what's important, not the knowledge of the world, not the study of the world. And so the scene was set for the abandonment of objectivity. Reality was no longer important in philosophy. Reality was no longer important in art. And art and philosophy are two areas which must influence tremendously the whole of Western world. Then came the shock of the First World War. I don't think that there's any way we can imagine the magnitude of that shock. It was an ugly war beyond all imagining, and it was a war on a scale beyond all imagining. It was much bigger in scale than the Second World War. Many more people were killed than in the Second World War. It was a much more tragic war, and a more meaningless war. So the Second World War was fought over ideals, over concepts. The wickedness was being fought. The First World War was a purely political war. And then came the crazy 20s, which were not deep. They were terribly superficial, and one can understand that these were people. People in the 20s were people who had experienced the wars. And one must not confuse the 20s with the 60s. I said I don't understand much about the 20s, and I don't. But what I do understand is that one must not compare the 20s and the 60s. Because the 60s was performed by the children of people who'd lived through the Second World War. The 20s was acted out by people who were in the First World War. And one can understand that after all that shock and after all that misery and ugliness, there was this escape into this unreal world of these famous parties of the 20s, and where any of the 20s where anything went and any form of clothing went and any form of behavior went, there was no restriction whatever on anything. But that was superficial. It wasn't a philosophy. It wasn't lechatchila. Nobody went out and preached such a philosophy. It was just a release of the tension of ugliness that to which they were exposed and the tensions of human misery. It was a runaway from an escape from the misery of the First World War. The consequence of that had to be the depression of the 1930s, because that was a totally egocentrical existence where everybody was trying to chap as much as they could. They'd seen a war, they'd seen what happens in war, they wanted to be secure against future wars, so everybody was chapping as much as they could. When everybody chaps as much as they can, you have recession. There's nothing else you can have. So the 30s was to be expected. When there's recession and everybody wants to chap, then there has to be war. So the 40s were to be expected. The 50s was a reconstruction of the war destruction. There was a certain sanity, a certain sadness in the world, a seriousness. The war was over. The game of the 20s were over. The recession of the 30s were over. It was time to rebuild destruction of 30 years, of 40 years. In the 50s, it wasn't just the destruction of the Second World War that was rebuilt, because there was still destruction from the First World War, ideological destruction and material destruction. And so the 50s was an incredible period and probably the most sane and productive period that we've had this century. It was a time when everybody got on with their job of work and everybody pulled together. Enemies helped one another. America put money into Germany. The West put money into Japan. And a whole new system was created which brought about extreme wealth towards the end of the 50s and the early 60s. What I want to start looking at seriously is the 60s. Because the 60s is in my opinion, the culmination of the whole 20th century. If the 20th century stands for hefkeiros, if the 20th century stands for lack of discipline, for abandon, then the 60s was the epitome of what was being striven for. What is hefkeiros? Hefkeiros is an attempt to detach cause from effect. That's all. If I understand the effect of my actions, I take my actions seriously. Then there's no hefkeiros, then there's seriousness. There can only be hefkeiros and fun, as the world understands the word fun, if I believe that my actions have no consequences. So we create fun parks today, for example. You go to Disneyland. That's a place where what you do has no consequence. That's why it's fun. You can abandon yourself. You can do what you want, because everybody's doing it. It's all kid stuff. And you become a child again. What's the beauty of being a child? Doesn't really matter what you do, your parents will cover up for you some way or another. And smash their cutlery and crockery and the worst. You might get a hiding if your parents are very unreasonable, but in today's modern age, who would think of giving their children a hiding in any case? So it's the opportunity for abandon. That's what it is, that's what it means to be a child. And Disneyland is the opportunity for an adult to play like a child. And people enjoy it and it's very relaxing. Let's see some of the things that happened in the 50s. Because it appears, on looking back, that there's no connection between the 50s and the 60s. But if our principle was correct at the beginning, that you'll find the seed of every new decade or every new era in the previous era, then the seed of the 60s must have been in the 50s. I believe that the seed of the 60s was one invention which took place in 1954. Many inventions, I'm oversimplifying it, but I think by far the greatest in the sense that we're discussing was an invention that took place in 1954, the invention of the contraceptive pill. Because now all of a sudden, the action which brought with it the most hedonistic pleasure, together with
the greatest responsibilities could be separated into two. Now you could have the fun without the responsibility. And that created a whole new way of looking at responsibility and at fun.
And it's amazing how quickly this caught on. I don't think we have any perception, because it didn't catch on that quickly here. But in America, within a couple of years, you know how fussy the Americans are about new medical medicines and things. They take years before they pass it, and they try it on mice and rats and owls and dogs and cats and everything before they let a human being touch it. But within a couple of years, 6 million women were taking the pill in America. So much were they craving for it. So much was it needed. So much was it desired. And so one had here, in the area where the Ribbono Shel Olam gives the human being his greatest responsibility, man discovered a device to remove the responsibility and say you can have fun without the responsibility.
Furthermore, the responsibility, what little was left, was taken from the man and given to the woman. You know what a change this is in whole outlook, in intersexual relationships, in interpersonal relationships, not only between husband and wife, but between man and woman? But now, whereas the man used to be responsible and had to understand that the consequences of a relationship with a woman could be children, and that if he wanted a relationship with a woman, she had to not only satisfy him as a girlfriend and as a wife, but also as a mother to his children. Now this was no longer the case. You could have a girlfriend, you could have a mistress, you could have all sorts of things that didn't have to be mothers. And mothers you could have as well. You could choose for your mothers, for the mother of your children, you could choose one kind of woman. And for the woman that you wanted to just have fun with, you could choose somebody else. And the responsibility, what little there was left, is now in her hands. She decides, has to take this decision which before was shared, is now totally in her hands, as to whether children might or might not result from that relationship. It's a whole new era. And one can quite easily say that in 54, which was right bang in the middle of the century, was the change, the beginning of a new a whole new concept in human, in Western society. There were other aspects at the same time. There was technology, which flourished in the 50s. Technology does the same in a way. Technology creates a distance between cause and effect. We've talked about this before. There used to be a time where if I wanted light in my house, I had to rub two stones together until I could get a spark out. And then I had to light a piece of paper or something from that spark and so build up a bit of a fire. There was a time that I knew that if I didn't go and chop the wood, I wouldn't have a fire in my house and I would be cold. There was a time that I knew if I didn't go out and hunt, I wouldn't have food in my home. There was a time that I knew that if my wife didn't sit and sew and knit, the children wouldn't have clothes for the winter. But that's all gone. You want light, you put on the switch. You want heat, you turn on the heater. You want clothes, you go and buy clothes. So you'll say to me, but still you have to work for the money. No, you get it on credit. The bank's got the money. So you don't need anything. It's the power station that gives you the light. It's the waterworks that gives you the water. It's the building society that gives you the house. And it's the bank that gives you everything else you've got. You don't need anything.
Don't forget, there was not much restriction on credit during the 60s, during the boom years, where any little schoolboy could virtually get what he wanted on a credit card. And so one found here too, that people ceased to realize that unless you work, you don't have.
That a child at university should be driving a car. Now, where does he get the car from?
His parents.
And it's meshuggah, it's crazy. Unproductive, not working, not doing anything for society. People complain that sometimes people learn in kollel for years and years and they don't give anything to society. Okay, they don't take anything from society either. They don't drive around in motor cars. And here you've got a student in first year university driving around an expensive motor car.
Okay,
so he got it from the old folks. And how does he relate to the old folks? As a recipient of charity relates to a giver of charity, because that's what it is? No. It's his right, that motor car. It's his. And what did you do to deserve that motor car? What did you do that was the cause of the effect of having a motor car? You don't need to do any cause. We have rights. And here you've got next and perhaps the most important movement of all that created the problems that we're living in now. And that's liberalism. Liberalism means that you can get without trying. That's what it means. Equal distribution of wealth. What does that mean, equal distribution of wealth? But the guy who works hard and the guy who lazes around should earn the same. That means there should be no relationship between effort and reward. There should be no relationship between cause and effect. You can sit at university without even working and you can drive a motor car. Okay, go around and tell everybody it's charity you took it from. No, but you'll go around scoffing at people who come collecting charity. And you'll get upset when your father gives somebody charity and you'll say, why don't you send them out and work, let them be productive. That's what that same university student will do, is driving around in his car. So where does he get the car from? Also from charity. That's not charity, that's my rights. The blacks have rights. Minorities have rights. Women have rights. What is this obsession with rights? If you try, you get. No, rights, this obsession with rights is the demand to effect without cause. The demand for reward without effort. Don't say there aren't areas of injustice, both in relationship to blacks and to women and to many others, and those areas of injustice have to be fought, but not as rights, as obligations. Someone has to get up and teach people what their obligations to women are, what their obligations to blacks are, what their obligations to minorities are. But it's not for the women to talk about their rights and the blacks to talk about their rights and everybody to talk about their rights, and nobody talks about obligations at all. This equal distribution of wealth and this communistic tendency, which is so destructive, which we're going to see in a moment, together with the pill and technology and impressionism and existentialism and all the rest of it, is what went to lay the fertile ground for the 60s. And then came the 60s, where finally all values were overthrown. There was no religion. There was no parental authority. There was no tradition. There was nothing of any authority whatever. And this created massive problems. Margaret Mead says it was something like imagining two ballet dancers dancing in an informal ballet where there are no fixed steps. So you've got to constantly figure out not only what am I going to do next, but what is the next person going to do next. Now, there used to be a time when you used to go to a Froom wedding and it was very beautiful. It looked, in fact, if you stood on a chair and you looked down at the people dancing, it looked like Strauss's ballrooms, except men and women separate. You would find a big circle of people dancing this way and a little circle inside dancing the other way and a little circle inside dancing another way, and all sorts of patterns would be made by the way the people were dancing together. You go to a Froom wedding today and everybody's doing their own thing. Nobody's dancing together. Two people here with their arms around each other dancing, and two Michiganers there with their arms around each other dancing. Nobody's being the Sameach, the Chos, and the Kalah. They're all just jumping up and down and having a good time. That's not it. There's a formality to it. If you want to be Mesameach, the Chos, and the Kalah, let all these guests get together and produce something of beauty. He doesn't want to just see you jumping up and down. He wants to see his guests doing something together. But we're not in that environment. We don't do things together. We don't know the steps. And learn the steps? No, who's got the time to learn the steps? So we want the pleasure of dancing without the obligation of learning the formality of steps. Even yeshivish dancers, even Froom wedding dancers, there are many different ones, each with their own steps and variations. And one needs to learn these things. There was a time when you could learn them in yeshiva. You went to a dance and you went to a wedding, and the first time you tripped over your feet, and you watched and you quietly got your chavrusa to teach you in your room when nobody was looking, and you went back next time and you tried a bit better, and so you picked up the steps. But they're formal steps. There's a way to dance. Now, where do you go to a Froom wedding today where people have taken the trouble to find out before they go, how do you dance? What do you do? What are the steps? Nobody cares what the steps are. Do your own thing. It's not important. It's back to the impressionism and the existentialism at the turn of the century. If a rule is broken, it's not that serious. A person does an avera, there's tshuva. Can be handled if you break the rule. But when there isn't a rule at all, there's chaos. And the 60s was the time when the rules were broken down. Before that, rules were broken. In the time of the 20s and even before then, rules were broken and everybody knew about it. But there were rules. There was a formality of how to live. How to be a husband, how to be a wife. What a husband's meant to do, what a wife's meant to do. What a parent's meant to do, what a child is meant to do. And everybody grew up in the secure knowledge of what to do. And sometimes they broke the rules. It doesn't matter. And imagine going into a nuclear power station and being told, okay, would you run the thing here for 2 weeks? And not bothering to find out how to do it before. Life is no less complicated and serious than a nuclear reactor. And there are rules to it. It's a professional game living. It's not something one just does by ear. Although everybody is born with a certain natural intuition, You might be born with a natural intuition to dance. You might be born with a natural intuition to play music. But there are rules. You've got to still learn how to do it. You might be the most musical person, but you've got to learn the formal theory of music before it's any good.
In the 60s, this formality of, I'm not sure about that, but whatever happened, they didn't. And nobody else did. The hepkerus has a
terribly severe consequence. The consequence is a feeling of impotence. If I'm not responsible for my actions, that means my actions have no effect. Then I have no effect. And what can I do in the world? You know, it's like you're sitting around a roulette table gambling, and the stakes are high and the tension is high, and somebody comes and says, look, come, fellas, this is getting dangerous. Let's play without chips. Well, we'll gamble without chips. Just let's have fun together here. So they sweep all the chips off the table and you carry on gambling.
It's fun for the first one or two rounds, and you just guess the number, and it's either right or wrong, and you try again. And then what do you start doing? You start smoking, and you start talking, and you start drinking, and you start smoking other things. There's no pleasure in the gambling anymore. You've got to find other things to amuse yourself with.
You're not responsible for what you're doing on the table. It makes no difference if you win or you lose any case. That becomes boring. And you become ineffectual. And the result of the 60s was a feeling of total worthlessness with which we approached the 70s. And unfortunately, people didn't realize that because there was such a dynamic atmosphere in the 60s. It was a very exciting time. Don't get me wrong. Things were produced in the 60s. Things happened. You know, even if something is produced with which one disagrees, it's stimulating. So you take issue with the thing you disagree, and out of that comes something worthwhile. In the 70s, nothing happened. But in the 60s, there was dynamicism. And we fooled ourselves into thinking as we approached the 70s that we were approaching as important human beings. We'd made some progress. We'd overthrown all this nonsense of the Victorian age. We'd taken steps forward, strides forward. That's what we thought. That was our mistake. We were pathetic little individuals, full of self-doubt, full of complexes, full of feelings of impotence. And divorce rates started going up, and sexual problems between husband and wife started increasing. Effectiveness started deteriorating. Health started deteriorating. And all of a sudden one found that we were dealing with people who were no giants. They were people who had shocked themselves with what they had done in the 60s. They didn't know that they were capable of falling so low. They didn't know society was capable of falling so low. And we moved into the 70s on the real bottom, thinking that we were a little bit higher than we really were.
Well, if one feels ineffectual,
if one feels impotent, if one feels that one can't achieve anything and can't do anything anyway, what's the next step? Narcissism. Okay. So there's nothing in the world but me. The atmosphere of the 20th century has been hepkerus. The fruit of the 20th century we reaped in 1970 onwards. Narcissism. And this was the decade that Tom Wolfe called the me decade.
And he didn't mean it in this way. But there are several articles that he's written, and that others have written even better articles since him,
quoting his phrase that is used to connotate the essence of the 1970s as the me decade.
The decade in which nothing matters but me. And anything goes as long as it suits me and as long as I'm stronger than you. So you have terrorism, you have obsession with health, jogging, health foods, smoking. They might all be very good. It might be very good that smoking's been cut down and the jogging's been increased, but there's been this obsession with it all of a sudden. People terribly worried about their own health, you know, they heart attacks, and everybody reads and listens, and everybody's very nervous about their own health, and everybody becomes very much of a hypochondriac. That's part of the atmosphere of the 70s. When you're busy with something bigger than you, there's a bit of materialist nefesh. You throw yourself in and you don't care what happens to you in the process. What you're doing is worthwhile. Not in the 70s. There was no materialist nefesh in the 70s. Terrorism is not materialist nefesh. We'll discuss that in a moment, what it is. They're different forms, but a terrorist who knows he's stronger, that's bullying, that's not Mesiris Nefesh. But Mesiris Nefesh, people putting their heads on the block for an ideal,
That never happened in the 70s. It did in the 60s. People put their heads on blocks over and over again for liberalism, for women's lib, for all these rotten things, and for many great things as well. And some succeeded and some failed, but the dynamics was that people were putting their heads on blocks. People were giving their lives for it. People were coming out in the open and taking issues and sacrificing their jobs and their positions for the issues they were taking. That was the mood of the 60s. It was confused, it was chaotic, but there was character. In the 70s, nobody would open their mouth if it would endanger their job. Nobody would open their mouths if it would endanger their lives. That's it. That's the era where you would walk past somebody being beaten in the street and you wouldn't do a thing. So why should I interfere? One thing doesn't fit into this that clearly. And that is, there's one movement that's taken place during the 70s which seems to be positive. The Balchuva movement started in the 70s, right in the beginning of the 70s. An incredible wave of interest in rigorous, formal, no-nonsense Yiddishkeit. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, with extreme suddenness, it took everybody by surprise. There were no institutions ready to cater for them. There was this incredible wave of interest and commitment to Yiddishkeit from the most unlikely people. And many of us sitting here today are the result of the Balchuva movement in the 1970s. And it wasn't only in Yiddishkeit. Lahavdil, it happened in all religions. At the beginning of the 1970s, the end of the 1960s, in fact, it started already with Eastern religions, and then it moved over to Christianity and to other forms of Western religions. I remember the shock I had when I first met a Muni. What I was shocked by was the way he was dressed like somebody in the 50s. That which the hippies were rebelling against in the 60s, and Muni in the 70s, that's what he was. Dressed like everybody else, formal, disciplined, worked, talked like a mensch. And my first exposure to Muni was before I'd understood the swing back to religion. I couldn't understand it. And one found the different cults developing in the 70s. Jones and his crowd, Moon, and many, many others that we don't even hear about. How do we understand that? If the 1970s was a period of narcissism, if the 1970s was an era where nobody would put their heads on the block, where nobody would commit themselves for anything outside of their own immediate lives, it was the time when parents stopped having children because that was not self-centered enough for them. It became fashionable not to have children at all. I'm not talking about restricting the sizes of families. In the States, it has become fashionable and correct not to have children at all. So far has the narcissism gone. Where does the religion come from all of a sudden? To the extent where they elected a religious president in America. A man who made no secret of his religion. He teaches Sunday school. Can you imagine in the 60s a president like that in the States? Okay, there was also a religious one, but everybody knew that his religion was only a formality. Everybody knew that he didn't take it terribly seriously. He certainly wouldn't have taught Sunday school, and he wouldn't have quoted from the Bible in his campaign speeches. Okay, you've got a man who goes around campaigning on the back of the Bible, openly religious, undertaking to run the United States religiously, in a sense, and he's voted into power, unknown, nobody's heard of him before, unprofessional, untrained, from the street. Into the White House and religion. How does one understand this? About a year ago, I was speaking very frequently in numbers of shiurim about the developments in Iran. And people thought I had a bug in my head about Iran. All he talks about is Iran. The reason wasn't just because I happened to understand the position in Iran, having been there several times previously. The reason was because I saw in that the change from the 1970s to the 1980s. And I realized at that time, you will remember, because I said so several times in the shiur, that the world will never be the same again. This is not just a little revolution in some Middle Eastern country. This is a world revolution. This is something of major consequence. And here too, you have a man who turns a country back in terms of Western type technology centuries and imposes rigorous religious laws on them. No alcohol, no mixed swimming. Can you imagine what would happen if in Israel they tried to do what Khomeini is doing? And I've spoken to many Iranians, and if we think that he hasn't got the backing of the Iranians, we're wrong. He doesn't have the backing of the intelligent, of the upper class Iranians. He doesn't have the backing of the wealthy Iranians, but they've fled the country. The tens of millions of Iranians would go up to make Iran are fully behind this. They love it. How is that possible? Imagine somebody this over 10 say all beaches are now separate, no mixed swimming, no mixed seating in cinemas, and everything will be severely censored. No alcohol, no this, no that, and we would run it strictly alpi halacha, imagine, never mind alpi Islam. Imagine running Israel alpi halacha, the problems we would have, or we would have had a little while back. The turn to religion, unfortunately, and this perhaps is the most important aspect of what I've got to say tonight, is not a turn to religion. And we must be careful not to fool ourselves. Mooneyism is not religion. Jones is not religion. Ayatollah Khomeini is not religion. And I say with great hesitation and after a lot of thought that a large extent of what is happening in the Baal Tshuva movement is also not religion. Certainly not our religion. We have to understand it clearly. While there's a certain wondrousness taking place, while there's a certain tremendous step forward in many areas, religiously, and this has opened incredible possibilities, let us see it as potential, but not as having arrived, because we've gone far from having arrived, we've arrived with problems. Let's understand it. How does a generation that craves for hefkeiros cleave to formal religion? And not just formal religion, the more extreme the better. The more irrational the better. The heavier the better. The harder it comes on the better. The more brutal the better. The more you make trite, the kosher it is. Where does such religion come from? Is that religion? Khomeini, every time he comes out with another word of Lashon Hara against anybody, they love him all the more. Every time something else is trite, he increases his stature in terms of holiness. And the same with the Western religious leaders. And the same, unfortunately, with a lot of Torah leadership. If he wants to make a name for himself as a Torah leader, he's got to make something trait, which was kosher before. If he wants to make a name for himself, it's got to come heavy. I, Mr. Khomeini, is killing people in the name of religion. Doesn't matter, it's for the Ribono Shel Olam. I, Jones, killed 1,000 people in one go, including himself. It's in the name of religion. In Torah, in Yiddishkeit, we talk Lashon Hara with blatantly. We destroy each other, we destroy ourselves, we go out deliberately to destroy what other people are building. It's for the sake of Yiddishkeit. Do you hear what he says? It's not the kind of Yiddishkeit we propagate, so it can't be tolerated. It's murder. But it's kosher. What we've done now is we've found a heksher for hefkeiros. We still do what we want, but in the guise of religion. How did that happen? Very simply, it's the result of narcissism. In the case of narcissism, you remember we said that the feeling is one of emptiness. The feeling is one that I am a nothing. I can't achieve anything. I don't stand for anything worthwhile. I'm not responsible for anything. I'm just a cog in a wheel. Now the way to handle that, if one wants to retain one's hefkeiros and not feel so empty, is you need a Hitler, that's all. You need somebody to come along and tell you, of course you're a nothing, my friend, but we're all nothings. But the motherland is not nothing, Islam is not nothing, Christianity is not nothing, and the Havdilele Favdolos Torah is not nothing, so come you nothings, if we all give our lives for this, that's okay, then you'll feel something. The greatest level you can achieve in Islam is to give your life for it. And the greatest level you can achieve in Christianity is to give your life for it in some forms of Christianity. In other forms, don't worry, Yoshke will do it for you. We've created a religion, and I'm talking now in all religions that have become fashionable, a method of feeling importance without responsibility. In Iran, you don't have responsibility. You can go and kill people in the street. As long as it's in the name of religion, and as long as Mr. Khomeini told you it's a good thing to do, you can go and do it, and there's no problem. Jones tells you to commit suicide because that's the holiest thing you can do. And these were intelligent people that Jones had. They weren't madmen. They weren't cranks. They were intelligent, bright people. People that everybody knew. You would bump into people in the States who knew whose neighbor was involved there. Just ordinary people like all of us. But Jones is able to convince you that you're nothing unless you give your life for something. And what something? His brand of religion. And so it goes on. In Yiddishkeit too, we've created a Yiddishkeit which is certainly foreign to Lithuanian Yiddishkeit from which we all stem. Lithuanian Yiddishkeit is based, and that's the Yiddishkeit of the Vilna Gaon, and it's the Yiddishkeit of the Pshimon Shkop, and it's the Yiddishkeit of all the Lamdonim and all the Talmidei Chachomim, and it goes back right to the time of the Rishonim. The principle is responsibility. You are responsible. Nobody will tell you what to do. We'll show you halacha. We'll teach you. But you decide what you want to do, and you bear responsibility for what you do. A concept of going to a Rebbe, and I don't mean this necessarily in a Hasidic sense, because a Rebbe is no longer a Hasidic phenomenon. It's something that is practiced worldwide now. You ask, he tells you, you do. That's it. Not your fault. He told you to do it. You don't have to sit and think and work out whether it's right or wrong. The Rebbe told you to do it. And I stress again, I'm not talking about any particular Rebbe, and I'm not even talking about Hasidim. I'm talking about Yiddishkeit as it's developed over the last 10 years. All forms of Yiddishkeit. There's a tendency to find in Yiddishkeit a means that will enable me to carry on what I want to do and not to have any kind of responsibility for it. And we've created Rabbeim, big and great ones, and little ones. And we've created concepts such as Das Torah. Of course there's a thing such as Das Torah. Das Torah means the Torah's attitude. But how do you find out Das Torah? You learn, and you study, and you go yourself to a Talmid Chochem, and you question him, and you understand, and you ask him. That's how you find out Das Torah. You don't pick it up in the streets. But today we pick up Das Torah in the streets. It's a word which is flashed around by many ignorant people. That's the Torah's view. This is how it's supposed to be. Well, that's the Torah's view. That's what I'll do. And now we find all of a sudden that there's Das Torah as to which school to send your children to and which school not to send your children to. You can't send your children to that school. I mean, that's, can you imagine what that would be? Why? Because the Gedolim say so. Which Gedolim? Who Gedolim? What Gedolim? Okay, that's the case. I'll send my child to that school. Can't go wrong if I'm following the Gedolim. No responsibility. No effort to find out for yourself. Is it right? Which Gadol said so? Is the Gadol that you're obliged to follow? Are there other Gadolim who maybe say differently? Makes no difference. Do I want the responsibility of finding out, of checking what can be done, what can't be done, what may be read, what may not be read, what may be seen, what may not be seen? These things are just handed out like mass medicine to everybody. The same kind of treatment for everybody. Standard rules as to what can be done and what can't be done. And these rules are handed round and handed down, and they relieve all responsibility of checking up the halacha from ourselves. You just ask your neighbor, are you allowed to do this? Is such and such kosher? Your neighbor says yes. That's kosher. That's all you have to do. She knows she's a prim person. She covers her head. Why shouldn't she know? That's not how you find out whether something's kosher or not. Should I do this? Should I do that? You ask around. What do people say? Oh, Rabbi so-and-so told so-and-so, according to so-and-so, that he should do this. So probably that's the right thing to do. Sure, it's the right thing. Rabbi so-and-so is a big guy. The fact that there's six people in the link doesn't matter. We don't want to find out. We don't want clarity. Because clarity brings with it responsibility. Clarity brings with it obligation, A, to establish the clarity, and B, to follow the clarity. And so we've created like Lahavdil. Might sound strange, but like Lahavdil. These other weird religions. We've created a weird insanity within Yiddishkeit. And we've created a religion which relieves us of responsibility. You don't have to know, you don't have to understand, just find out from around what is said and what is done, and that's what you do and that's what you say. So where's this all going to lead us? Into the 80s. And we stand at crossroads. Absolutely at crossroads. And that's why you would have to be a novi, you would have to be a prophet, to say which way the thing is going to develop. One can simply analyze the present. The present is, there are two lines in front of us. One of them we're going to follow. What are the two lines? The first line is that we will persist with this insane religion, both in Yiddishkeit and in other areas of religion. And more Khomeinis will rise. Nationalism is also a religion. Communism is also a religion. When I talk about religion, I don't necessarily mean formal religions such as Yiddishkeit and Lahavdil Islam. Talking about religion, we're talking about some brutal dictator getting up in various parts of the world, affirming people's vision of themselves that they are in fact nothing, but that by following him in the service of the religion, the motherland, the concept, whatever, they will find salvation. That's the one line that can be followed. And that is a line the end of which has to be self-destruction. At the end of that line, and not very far down the line, you have world war. Without any question. All you need is another Khomeini in America. And you've got world war right then. And who knows how long the Americans are going to allow their president not to be a Khomeini. They're looking for it now. They're ready for it now. One talented person with a personality, with a dynamicism, and with the ideas, could come up now and could establish such backing and such unity among these Americans. And they have such power when they're together. And they would march into self-destruction, to destruction of one another. Maybe that's the thing which has to be done. Certainly if one follows this. Or, we start again. First World War, 20s, depression, Second World War. 50s, 60s, depression, Second World War. The First World War, then the 20s, 30s, 40s, Second World War, 50s, 60s, 70s, Third World War, 90s, 2000s, Fourth World War, and so it could go. One can't, unless one's a novice, as I said, say when the Mashiach is going to come. We believe, and it's an essential belief, that the time is right at any moment. But it's feasible, chas v'sholom, that we simply repeat our old mistakes and do the same thing all over again. That's the one line that we could take. There's another line. The world has shown that it is ready for leadership. It's prepared to subject itself to uncompromising leadership. This is the first time that this has happened since the Second World War. When they kicked Churchill out, and they kicked any responsible and powerful president out in America, and particularly since Vietnam and Watergate, this is the first time that again in the West there's a searching for strength of leadership and a readiness to submit to strong leadership. The one kind of leadership we've just discussed, and they're ready for that. But there is another kind of leadership, and that is a leader who's able to cure the cause and not the symptom. Khomeini cures the symptom. He says, you feel like nothing's Iranian. You are nothing, but come together, we're very great. You follow me, and we'll conquer the world. This is a war of Islam against the infidel, says Khomeini. Sounds fantastic. Look what you're giving your life for. It's worse than the Sirius Nefesh. Alternatively, the world is ripe for leadership now. It says, what nonsense, you're a nobody. Let me show you who you really are. And that such leadership could create individuals of worth. And then it will no longer be nationalism, and it will no longer be the service of these strange cults. It will be each individual finding his own self-fulfillment and developing a self-confidence. And you'll find that there won't be this segregation of clubs. You'll have to wear a uniform as it is at the moment. I mean, now even in Yiddishkeit, you've got to wear a uniform which describes where you belong. And if you don't wear a uniform, the first question you'll be asked is, where do you belong? And that defines whether you're friend or foe. There's no way that there can be friendship across these lines, these club lines at all. Absolutely not. First, loyalty to the club. Second, loyalty to the Ribbono Shel. That's this new religion we've created, which is not Torah. I don't know what it is, but it's not Torah. It practices some of the same rituals, but don't forget, Lahavdil, Christianity practiced some of the same rituals for many, many years before it became Christianity. This religion that we've created looks very much like Torah from the outside, but if you see the social mechanism, that's not Torah at all. This is nationalism. This is cultism. And we make our own little cults within Torah. And we're prepared to die for our cults. But chas v'sholom, not to cross the line. That we'll never do. First loyalty is to the club. But that could all change as soon as there's a bit of self-confidence. As soon as I don't feel threatened by a member of the other cult, because I know that I'm worthwhile. I know where to find the din. I know what I'm meant to be doing and what I'm not meant to be doing. I know what other people are meant to be doing and what they're not meant to be doing. And I can have an objective discussion with somebody I disagree with. And I can show him this is the Chumash and this is what Rashi says and this is what Ibn Ezra says. And we can look up the Gemara and I'll show you how to understand this. And we can discuss it and he can ask questions. And he can say maybe it should be this way or maybe it should be that way. And I can say maybe let's check up. Let's ask someone a little bit more knowledgeable than myself. And nobody feels threatened. We all feel people of worth. And these barriers between the cults disappear. But for that, monotheism has to be introduced into the world. And monotheism means responsibility. That means there are mitzvahs, and there are averas, and nobody tells you what to do. All that can be done is you can be taught. What does Rebbe mean? Rebbe means teacher, not dictator. Rebbe means I'll sit with you and I'll teach you the Torah. You want to keep it, you keep it. You don't want to keep it, don't keep it. I asked Rabbi Shiller once what he does if he has young men in the Beis HaMidrash who don't want to put on tefillin. He says, it's not my business to make them put on tefillin. He says, it's my business to promote tefillin. It's my business to teach them to love the concept of tefillin. If I fail, I don't force it down anybody's throat. It's not my business to do so. One has the same concept that one has to come to here and to understand that it's not our business to go converting people, not Jews, not Gentiles. It's our business to teach Jews and Gentiles, to teach textually and to teach by example, to show that we're all people of worth, that we all have something to us, that we all know what's going on, that we have the intellect, we all could be Talmidei Chachomim. We were sitting at Sinai when the Ribbono Shel'olam gave us the Torah and commanded us, V'higisa bo yomam v'layla, study it day and night. Every one of us was there and heard that commandment, and it applies to every one of us. So nobody needs to go away feeling ashamed, I can't quite make it. Anybody can make it and everybody can make it. It just has to be presented correctly. It has to be presented in a way which is suitable to you, to your culture, to your background, to your personality. Sometimes it's presented more by way of illustration. Sometimes it's more technical, less technical, more formal, less formal. It depends on what you need. That everybody is capable of learning Torah, and everyone is not v'chayei olam, not ta'besoicheinu. The Ribbono Shel Olam gave us an eternal life. That's the Torah. Besoicheinu is inside us, not inside some intermediary, not inside some vague concept called gedolim. Which gedolim? What gedolim? Who gedolim? Doesn't matter. Gedolim. That's not Yiddishkeit. Sure, they're gedolim, but we know who they are. They're individuals. They're people. They're not a committee. They're not a vague concept somewhere. They're people, they're poskim, who know the halacha and announce the halacha. And one can ask them a shayla and one can get an answer. And one can ask one's owner of a shayla and he can put it to a gadol and get an answer for you. That's what gedolim means. Not the rumors that one hears in the street, that's not gedolim. For this last kind of leadership, and we're nearly finished, we need a person who can... I'm talking now not only about leadership of nations, I'm talking about leadership of ourselves. We have to be kinds of people, for ourselves and for others, who are able to inspire a desire for Yiddishkeit, for Torah values in the individual. We saw a little bit of this, Lahavdil, when the Pope made some of his trips. There's a new concept in leadership for the goyim. A man who is unflinchingly dedicated to dogma, will not move from old traditions, and loved by the people, because he had a way of coming across, of being human, together with that dogmatism. Now we need a little bit more than that. We need a naise v'nishma. We need a commitment to do that requires clarity. So our leaders in the 1980s are going to have to be people who can put across clarity. This is what the halacha is, and I'll show it to you. And then we need a nishma. We have to be able to sell that too. We have to make a person understand it, want to do it, because if you don't, that's, you can't take responsibility. If you're keeping Yiddishkeit because of social pressure, you'll never feel responsible for your own Yiddishkeit. It's not yours. You borrowed it. If you are keeping Yiddishkeit because some goggle or some individual told you what to do and you do it like a monkey, you'll never feel responsible. He told me to do it, so I did it. When will you feel responsible when there's nicer, when I do without question, if you show me this is the halacha, I do it. But there's also nishma, I want to understand it, I want to see it, I want to feel it, I want to have an individual feeling for it. Then I can take responsibility, because then it's my Torah, then it's my halacha, it's my din, I understand it and I'm voluntarily doing it because I want to do it. Then I can take the responsibility. But for that one needs a person who has confidence in what he's teaching, so he has to have authority. And he has to have independence. The leadership has to be independent. The leadership cannot be a leadership which is influenced by society. And that's part of our problem altogether in all spheres of leadership today. Where the leaders are not saying things they're really responsible for, because they've been pressurized into saying it by the society in which they live. And there can be no responsibility in the leadership. And so there's no teaching of what responsibility is. So what we're looking for is Malchus. We're looking for kings. Because we've discussed before the Tells of the Rav definition of Malchus. Malchus is a man who by his stature and clarity of intellect raises himself above his society and is intellectually totally independent from them. His thought process is exclusively his own. His authority is the authority of the Torah. That's it. But not influenced by the norms and by the pressures of society, whether it's religious society or secular society, Jewish society or non-Jewish society, it makes no difference. The Melech is a person who works it out for himself from the sources, based on the authority of his teachers and his rabbi. Now I said I would illustrate this to you. Not prove it, but illustrate it. Yaakov Avinu calls together his sons. We're not going to have a chance to go through all the sons, only three of them. He starts with Reuven. And he says to Reuven, Reuven, you should have been three things. You were the firstborn. At that time there were no Kohanim. At that time the firstborn was to be a Kohen. At that time the firstborn was of course to be a Bechor. And at that time the firstborn, not only at that time, always, the firstborn has the first option on Malchus, on royalty. Says Yaakov, Reuven Bechori Ata. Reuven, you are my Bechor, you are my firstborn. Koichi Vereshis Oini. Yeser Se'es V'yeser Oz. Apart from being Koichi Vereshis Oini, which is my Bechor, my firstborn, with all the authority and responsibility that being a Bechor carries, Yeser Se'es, you have an addition to that. Pachas Kamayim Altoisa, that you can't have any of these extra privileges because you are Pachas Kamayim. What is Pachas Kamayim? Ha Pachas V'habeholo Asher Mihartan Laharis Kasko Kamayim Alal Amaharim Bimrutzon Lekach. That's Rashi. Pachas means impetuousness, spontaneity. Yes, spontaneity is good in the right place, but not the spontaneity of the 60s. And Reuven showed on his incredibly high level, which we can't even understand, and I'm not going to go into explaining, but just in terms of Yaakov's criticism of Reuven, he says, Reuven, you have to forego all three. You're not going to be my Bechor, you're not going to have Kahuna, and you're not going to be the Melech. Why? Pachas, impetuousness. You get angry too quickly. What you get angry about might be deserving of getting angry about. That you act impetuously, you react emotionally. You can't be a leader. That's the 60s. A time for honesty. Brutal honesty. The hippie movement had incredibly brutally honest vision of their forebearers' society. The criticisms of the hippie movement were valid. They had nothing to replace it with. And Reuven, lahavdil elef havdolos, his anger was well placed. His emotions were accurate. But it was too quick. You don't react emotionally without thinking first. So Reuven forgoes these three areas of leadership. Who's next? Shimon. He says, Shimon v'Levi Achim. Let's treat Shimon and Levi together. Because they're brothers not only physically, they're brothers in outlook, they're absolutely the same. So let's treat Shimon and Levi together. Klei chomos mecheruseyem. Their tools are tools of chomos, of thievery and scheming. Again, on the level of Shimon and Levi. What's Shimon and Levi? Please understand the comparisons I'm making between the 60s and 70s and Lahavdil, Reuven and Shimon and Levi has to be understood carefully. I'm not making any comparisons that this is what was going on in their minds. These were incredibly great people. These were the pillars of the whole of Yiddishkeit. We all come from them. And we don't know from which ones we come. And they were all great. Every one of them had incredible greatness. They were all B'nai Yisrael. They were children of Yaakov Avinu. They were raised in his home. They were where it all started from. So no way can we belittle them, but we must understand the psukim to try and understand in our terms what it was that Yaakov found wrong with them that prevented him from giving them these privileges, these three privileges. Shimon and Levi did a few things. One of them was they wiped out the city of Shechem. What does Yaakov say to them when they wipe out those individuals? He says, how could you do this to me? Don't you realize that as a result of this, they're going to gang up, the Canaanim here are going to gang up and they're going to wipe me out? Yaakov's practical. He says, I understand your anger at what they did to Dino. I understand that they deserved what they got from you. But you've got to be practical as well. We're one family in a hostile world. And sometimes you have to contain your anger. You don't always act impetuously. What are Schumann and Levy answer? Hachazono yaate achisenu. Do you think we'll allow our daughter to be treated like a zoyna, to be treated like a prostitute? Yaakov doesn't answer them. But Yaakov doesn't excuse them either, because it comes back over here. What does that mean? Terrorism in the name of Yiddishkeit. Again, on the level of Shimon and Levi, this is not what we've got today. Something very, very different. But in terms of understanding the one point which made them unfit for leadership, sure it's in the name of Yiddishkeit. Surely it's for moral principles, for great ideas. But it's not right. It's not allowed. It's hefkeirus. You can't go killing people. You make a deal with them that if they have a bris and they convert, you'll intermarry with them. They do what you say, and then you go out and kill them. Kill the guy who raped your sister. Again, kill the whole lot of them. That you can't have. That's terrorism. That's blackmail. They were also the ones that were responsible for what happened to Yosef. They sat out and worked it all out. They justified it. They knew why they were doing it. It was all for good reason. But it wasn't the right thing to do. That's not what you do to a brother. They were the ones. Korach was from the family of Levi. Also from the Shem Shemayim. The machlokes of Korach was for the sake of the Ribbono Shel Olam. They're Baalei machlokes. They cause machlokes wherever they go, Shimon and Levi. All for the sake of Yiddishkeit. Righteous indignation. They cause argument, they cause division, and they cause derision. And for that, what do they get as a punishment? By the way, Yaakov says here, I don't want to sit with Sodom al-Tovo in their scheming. I don't want to come, because these are people who scheme. On their greatness and in their greatness, they plot and they scheme and they work out to get the enemy. Nafshi b'kaholom al-Teichad k'voidi. My al-Tovo nafshi b'kaholom al-Teichad k'voidi. Let my honor never come into their kahilos, into their community. And that's what Yaakov wants to prevent, that these people should ever get together to make a community, because that would be destructive. Achalkem b'Yaakov, v'afitzem b'Yisrael. I'm going to spread them out over the whole Jewish people. So Levi has no territory, and Shimon becomes the teacher. Both Levi and Shimon become the cheder teachers, and the teachers, and the rabbonim. So every community needs a few Levim, and they need a few from Shimon. They need teachers. They don't gang together. They can't create a community of their own. They're very valuable in a community because they teach unadulterated, uncompromising Yiddishkeit. The most wonderful thing for a child to hear and for a child to be taught. These are the principles, and we don't care if we're going to be killed in the process. But you can't have them forming communities. That's destructive. Comes the last one, Yehuda. So the 60s are over. The impetuousness of the Reuven is over. And the righteous indignation of a Shimon and a Levi is over, and now we come to Yehuda. Yehuda, ato yoiducho achecho, your brothers will accept you and acknowledge you. Yistachavulucho b'nei avicho, they'll bow down to you, etc. Royalty goes to Yehuda. But the chora goes to Yosef, which we haven't got time to discuss, and the kahuna and so on. But royalty goes to Yehuda. Why Yehuda? Yehuda's name comes from Moide, from to admit, to acknowledge. Chazal tell us the thing which caused him to deserve royalty was the fact with the story with Tamar. You remember, and I'm not going into explaining the story of Tamar, but he goes off and he sees Tamar, who now dresses herself up as a prostitute. He has a relationship with her, and there's some beautiful Chazal and what all that meant and how it happened. And later on, he hears he didn't know it was Tamar, of course. And later on he's told, your daughter-in-law Tamar is pregnant. She's been prostituting herself. Says Yehuda, so the din is Srefa. She's a Bas Kohen, she's the daughter of Shem. Shem was a Kohen, and a daughter of a Kohen who's had a prostituting relationship with other men, the din is Srefa. Capital punishment, she has to be killed. Take out Tamar as much as I love her, and she has to be killed. Tamar says, okay, that's how it is, that's all right. But the man with whom I had that relationship is him. Yehuda says, you're right. Tzadko mimeni, she's more righteous than I am. You know what it is for a king to stand in the presence of somebody regarded by the community as a prostitute being accused of the other being the other party, and saying, she's right. That's Yehuda. That's a man who's prepared to take responsibility for what he did. That's all it is. The ability to be moider, the ability to admit to having done something wrong, is a midah of malchus, a midah of royalty. It means I'm prepared to take the responsibility, I'm prepared to take the rap. Yes, I did it. Yehuda's done some other things. One might think that as a king, he imposes his will on his surroundings. He must be able to affect his surroundings, he must be able to discipline them. Yes, he does. On two occasions already, Yehuda has disciplined his surroundings. The first case was in the sale of Yosef, where he says, Ma betzaki nahargena. Brothers, what are you going to get out of killing him? Is that a king or a politician? It's a king. His aim is to get them not to kill Yosef. And he has to appeal to them in a way that they'll understand. Not by saying, brothers, you shan't kill Yosef. That's a dictator. That's a bully. That's a terrorist. That's not Malchus. Malchus is selling it. Malchus is convincing them that there's no point in doing it. And he succeeds. The other case is with Paro, or with who he thought was Paro's servant. It was in fact Yosef. So Vayigash Eil of Yehuda, Yehuda draws up, and we're told with tremendous power and threats he draws up to Yosef. And he starts talking. What does he say? I've got an old father, and I promised him before I left that he starts playing on Yosef's sympathy. Is that a politician? That's a melech, it's a master psychologist. He knows what will appeal to Yosef. He knows that he's an emotional man and that he's a tzaddik inside. No big thing, I'll smash you if you don't give Yosef, if you don't give Binyamin back, which he was quite capable of doing. No, it's delicate. He sells the idea slowly. He builds it up with incredible dramatic skill until he breaks Yosef down. That gets Binyamin back. But he offers to go in place of Binyamin. I brought Binyamin down. I'm prepared to take responsibility. Yosef, take me, put me in jail, do what you want with me, but let Binyamin go. That's a man who's prepared to take responsibility for his actions. It's the opposite of hefkerus. It's the opposite of abandon. The man who understands that there's cause and effect, and I'm prepared to suffer the effect of my action and to reap the rewards of my action. That's Yehuda. That's Malchus. And here we have what we hope we'll go into the 1980s with. Having had our time of Reuven and we suffered. And having had our time of Shimon and Levi and Oav, we suffered over the last 10 years, probably the most ugly decade that we've ever had. Not as dramatic as the world wars, but constant bad news. Open any newspaper over the last 10 years and it's miserable reading, it's unpleasant, it's ugly, it's decadent, not in a 60s way, but just in a totally immoral way. It's degenerate, there's nothing left. But there comes a time now for Yehuda. If we can have leadership among ourselves and in ourselves, within each one of us, and national and international and Jewish leadership, which now will learn to be a Yehuda, someone who has sufficient confidence in himself and in his views to be able to sell them. To sell an article, you need to have the skill of salesmanship, and you need to have confidence that the article is good. Otherwise it's difficult to sell it if you don't have confidence that the article is good. And you need to be prepared to give a backup service. You must be prepared to guarantee the article. So if we will have salesmen who will be sufficiently confident in their Torah to be able to sell it rather than force it. Don't bully people into Yiddishkeit. Don't threaten them that if they don't come the walls of Gehenna are going to fall on them. It doesn't have to be heavy. It doesn't have to be miserable. It doesn't have to be self-denial. It can be pleasant, it can be beautiful, it can be lovely, it can be presented nicely and attractively. And if we have leadership that while remaining unflinchingly dedicated to the principles of halacha, without any compromise whatever, they're able to come across in a way which is one of salesmanship, that means I will not flinch from halacha, that's the way it is. But when I sit down with you, it's not you will not flinch from halacha. Why not? That's your business if you want to flinch from halacha. Why should I tell you not to? All I can tell you is, this is the halacha. This is where it comes from. This is what it means. This is its value. Look at it this way. Look at it that way. And hopefully be able to do a Yehuda. Be able to impress you sufficiently to give up your other ideas and to follow the way which is in fact the way of Torah. If that's what stands in front of us in the coming years, then also Mashiach stands at the end of it. And it's feasible that we could bring Mashiach without a third world war. It's possible that we've gone through the Third World War. It's possible that the 70s have been the Third World War. There's economic chaos. There's misery. There's war all over the world. Every country is involved in war. What greater world war could there be? There hasn't been one as long, and there hasn't been one as broad. And people are being killed, and lives are being lost in quality and in quantity. Maybe this is already the Gog and Magog. And maybe if now the right leadership would come, one would be able to find our way to re-establishing confidence in ourselves, and thus break down this cultism, break down this loyalty to weirdness, and create a loyalty to genuine halacha, to true Torah. But one mustn't try and conquer the world. Sas min ha'oyr doiche harbe min ha'choshech. A little bit of light in a dark room lights up the whole room. All we have to look after is ourselves to start with. We should see that our own families are not involved in this cultism nonsense. That there's no Lashon Hora allowed in our families in the name of religion, in the name of Torah, because no Lashon Hora is allowed in the name of Torah. That there should be no denigrating of those with whom we disagree. If you don't have the skill of Yehuda to bring others around to your way of thinking, then leave them alone. Don't sit and denigrate them. Just ignore them. Forget about them. There's no alternative to the Yehuda method. And if that's the way we are in our own families, and in our learning here in the Beis HaMedrash, if we get on with a job of sitting and learning Torah, understanding Torah, growing through Torah, enjoying Torah, which is so important. Now I say, having clarity in what we learn. Learning not just for the fun of it, but for the sake of collecting the knowledge with clarity to know what a piece of Gemara is, to know the Chazal, to know the Din. Nishma, to understand it, feel it, grow through it. Then we'll find that the years ahead of us are years full of promise and full of potential. Sorry I kept you considerably later than I planned, but I think this is...